From Oregon to Maine, New Mexico to Florida, this is American Radio Journal. On this edition, the Supreme Court of the United States has a docket packed with high-profile cases ranging from TikTok to abortion funding. Mike O'Neill from the Landmark Legal Foundation is here with details. President-elect Donald Trump huddled with Republican senators to plan quick enactment of his policy agenda. Scott Parkinson from the Club for Growth is here with the real story. President Joe Biden has blocked the proposed takeover of U.S. Steel by Japan's Nippon Steel. Eric Boehm of Reason Magazine looks at the fallout with Ryan Young of the Competitive Enterprise Institute. And Donald Trump 2.0 is set to take office. Colin Hanna of Let Freedom Ring USA gives us a peek at what lies ahead on this week's American Radio Journal Commentary. I'm Loman Henry, and welcome to American Radio Journal. Oral arguments in a number of high-profile cases are now taking place before the Supreme Court of the United States. For a look at what the justices are tasked with deciding, we turn to Mike O'Neill. He is Vice President of Legal Affairs at the Landmark Legal Foundation. Mike, welcome to American Radio Journal. Mike, the Supreme Court of the United States has a number of very important cases pending. They, of course, began their current session back in October, but now we're into the meat of the order here in terms of arguments and where things are going. Perhaps the case that has the highest profile involves TikTok. Can you bring us up to date on where that case stands?
So first, this case is incredibly important, TikTok versus Garland. Essentially what this is, last year, Congress passed a law forcing the divestiture of TikTok as a controlled entity by China. So they said, look, if TikTok's going to continue to operate in the United States, it can no longer be controlled and operated by China, by a Chinese entity. And why did the U.S. Congress do this? U.S. Congress did this because they recognized that TikTok posed a national security threat. The operation of TikTok by the Chinese government, the control, exercise of dominion and control over TikTok by the Chinese government, posed a national security threat to the United States. Well, TikTok, of course, argued that, hey, TikTok has 170 million users in the United States. This infringes upon their free speech rights. And to ban TikTok, to essentially prohibit the operation of TikTok in the United States, violates the free speech rights of not only TikTok, but the 170 million American users who utilize it and monetize it every day. So essentially, the case in front of the Supreme Court is this, is whether this law prohibiting the operation of TikTok in the United States as it is currently configured under the direction and control of the Chinese government constitutes a violation of the First Amendment to the United States Constitution, essentially the free speech clause of the First Amendment.
So that is a case where oral arguments have just been heard. Mike, about how long does it usually take the Supreme Court to come up with a ruling here? Because President Trump is now asking to have his say on the issue. How does that impact the process?
The law is set to take effect on January 19th. President Trump actually weighed in on this with a brief in on the docket and a brief in this case. And his position is that they hold the law in abeyance so he retains the ability to negotiate with the Chinese government. He wants to have this card in his hand. In other words, if he's going to be striking deals as he takes office, he's going to be striking deals and trying to negotiate deals with the Chinese government. He wants to be able to have this leverage of saying, look, TikTok operates in the United States. I have the control about whether we're going to prohibit it. The Congress has already passed a law banning it. We've managed to hold this in abeyance. China, you need to use this. He's going to use this in a negotiating posture. So normally decisions from the United States Supreme Court come down in big cases, come down in late May, June, early July sometimes. You can expect a decision in this case fairly quickly, though, because the court is aware of the urgency of the situation. Keep in mind this. If you look at it, the Supreme Court took this case on an expedited basis and is hearing this on an expedited basis. So we all know past has shown that the court can act quickly when necessary. And I think you can expect a decision fairly quickly, weeks, certainly not months in this case.
There's another free speech case before the court, Free Speech Coalition versus Paxton.
Right.
Tell us a bit about that case.
Now, this is a case where Texas and 18 other states have passed laws requiring age verification of browsers to access internet pornography. So if you're going to want to access pornography on the internet in these states, you have to verify your age. Now, the question here, again, we're coming back to a free speech case. question here is whether this law in Texas, and by extension these other laws, violate the free speech rights of these pornography companies. Free Speech Coalition is, again, a coalition of pornography companies that have come together to challenge these laws. Incidentally, there's laws in other states. For example, I think on January 7th, a district court in Tennessee stayed a Tennessee law that would require these age verification. Again, coming back here to this, is whether these laws violate the First Amendment rights of these pornography companies. And the question here is what level of scrutiny the Supreme Court is going to apply here, whether there is a less restrictive means of accomplishing this goal. Ostensibly, the goal in these cases, of course, is to protect children from access to pornography. The question here is whether there's a less restrictive means of protecting the children, instituting parental controls, for example. So we're really going to see how the court grapples with these First Amendment cases. Interestingly enough, oral arguments on that are scheduled for January 15th. So by the midpoint of January, you're actually going to have two cases that have had oral arguments regarding the First Amendment expression, really on internet cases. So the court is really grappling with how applications, how online pornography, how TikTok social media really interacts with the First Amendment, the free speech clause of the First Amendment.
It seems like we never have a session of the U.S. Supreme Court, Mike, where somehow abortion comes into play. We do have another case before the Supreme Court involving Planned Parenthood. Tell us a bit about that, please.
Right. This case is entitled Kerr versus Planned Parenthood of South Atlanta. This is a case in South Carolina. You're seeing these laws passed by state legislatures, probably red state legislatures, and they're being challenged by coalitions and groups. Look, the legislature in South Carolina said, no, Planned Parenthood is not going to have any access to Medicaid funds. These are state funds, through the Medicaid program. We're going to cut off Medicaid funding for Planned Parenthood because Planned Parehnthood conducts abortions, right? So you're going to see, again, the extent to which states really can regulate money, state resources that flow into organizations that provide abortion. So you're going to see really how far that state authority regarding regulation of abortion and state money really goes. And that's going to be Kerr versus Planned Parenthood versus South Atlanta.
And we have a case involving Second Amendment rights, ghost guns. Tell us a bit about that case.
Yeah, this is a case that, this is called Garland versus Vanderstock. This was going to be one of the bigger cases of the term coming into this term. These other cases we talked about before really hadn't been on the docket yet. But this case, oral arguments occurred already, I think, in December. So they've already happened. And what happened here is really the extent to which the Bureau of Alcohol, Tobacco, and Firearms can issue regulations that might be beyond its statutory purview. In this case, ATF issued a regulation that would prohibit ghost guns. Now, those are those firearm kits. You buy the kit, you put the gun together yourself. It's not necessarily you go to a gun store and you buy a gun. And the extent to which really the authority of the ATF is to regulate these ghost guns. The statutes were pretty quiet regarding this, so there was really significant questions about whether ATF had the legal authority under the statute, under the law, to regulate these. And so again, this is part of kind of the unending continuation of how far can the administrative state infringe upon the rights of individuals. Of course, when you're talking about guns, you're talking about the Second Amendment, the United States Constitution, our right to keep and bear arms. So whether ATF can issue these regulations that blanket prohibit these sorts of firearms. Now, oral arguments had already occurred. I think it's going to be interesting to see where this comes down. The court has erred on the side of more gun rights rather than fewer, and has also erred on the side of fewer administrative authority. In other words, these agencies like the EPA, the ATF, DHS don't necessarily have as much regulatory authority as they might have had a few years ago. So we're going to see where that one comes down. And that, again, is Garland versus Vanderstock.
We have again been talking with Mike O'Neill, who is Vice President of Legal Affairs at the Landmark Legal Foundation. Mike, tell us a bit about Landmark Legal Foundation. Also, where can we find you on the web?
Sure. You can find us at landmarklegal.org, landmarklegal.org. You can see all the great things we're doing. We're a nonprofit, nonpartisan, tax-exempt charity organization. We don't accept any money from the federal government. We don't accept any money from the states. We're wholly dependent on contributions from private individuals and private foundations. And in essence, we fight for liberty. We fight against tyranny. We want to reduce the size and scope of the administrative state. We want to preserve the separations of powers, and we want to preserve liberty for the American people.
Mike O'Neill of the Landmark Legal Foundation. Mike, thank you for being with us.
Oh, it's a pleasure to be with you. You have a great day.
Scott Parkinson at the Club for Growth. Of course, many, many, many big things are happening in the nation's capital as we are just really days away from the inauguration of President-elect Donald Trump, but a lot of action on Capitol Hill. Scott Parkinson has been keeping an eye on it. Scott, good to have you here.
Always great to be with you, Loman. Thank you.
Just a few days ago, President-elect Trump did sit down with U.S. senators. They huddled. There's been a lot of discussion now as to, getting the Trump agenda enacted and enacted quickly, a bit of discussion as to one reconciliation bill or two reconciliation bills. First of all, Scott, what is a reconciliation bill?
It's a great question. People are going to really start to hear about that term even more because of the intense scrutiny that the Trump administration is going to be taking on. And if you dial it all the way back to the Budget Act of 1974, it basically provided so-called fast-track legislative vehicle to getting things done. But it has to be budgetary in nature. It has to deal with revenues or with federal spending or with the debt limit. And then there's also a lot of precedent in the United States Senate on exactly what counts as something that is dealing with the budget compared to a big policy agenda. So what you, I think you're going to see the Trump administration trying to do is maneuver what's known as the Byrd rule and get really some big ticket items passed through the Congress with only Republican votes. The budget reconciliation bill is really technical. And as you navigate the process, there's going to be a real apprehension from some senators that I would probably term to be a part of the swamp or part of the uniparty that are going to say, well, we can't do that because that's basically like threatening the legislative filibuster. We've heard similar talk out of John Thune already, the new Republican leader in the United States Senate. But the issue here is whether Trump can actually deliver with Republicans in a slim majority of the House and the Senate and then avoid Chuck Schumer and the Democrats blocking his agenda. He has said that he wants to have a legislative package delivered quickly and dealing with the border situation and really illegal immigration. So if you're going to do that, right, you could do that in a way where you're going to provide money for Border Patrol agents and deportations and, you know, make it merely a bill that the parliamentarian of the Senate considers to be budgetary in nature. But there's going to be, appeals and a process that unfolds that slows it all down. And the question is, can they actually pass an immigration bill without attaching other items to sort of assuage concerns from other members and actually get things signed into law? Some members of Congress want to see the tax cuts extended, right? Tax policy is a big, big issue. And as we've been navigating the question of higher cost of living and inflation, some people say, well, the immediate relief we can give people is to make sure that their taxes don't go up and that we extend the Trump tax cuts from 2017. So in Washington, there's been this big debate behind the scenes and a little bit in the media on, is there going to be one reconciliation bill that moves very quickly in like the first 30 days? Or is there going to be two bills and, you know, you have the tax cuts that happen later on? You remember in 2017, we failed in repealing Obamacare. 9 months later, we got the Tax Cuts and Jobs Act signed into law. It's important for the American people to kind of recognize, number one, reconciliation is a pretty basic and standard way for a new administration to put points on the board and get things done. Joe Biden used reconciliation twice, and he did it first to do that big Biden stimulus bill. So he was thinking, how do we inject all this federal spending into the economy? And that's what actually caused inflation to happen. You remember we had this 40-year high when inflation was hovering around 9%. And I think that Trump is obviously going to continue that precedent because a budget reconciliation bill has been utilized by every president since the Budget Act of 1974. So it's not going to be like this brand new thing that's never happened before. Obamacare, for example, got signed into law through budget reconciliation. The Bush tax cuts from 2001, those happened through reconciliation. It is kind of the norm now in Washington to say, what can we do on the budget and spending side for revenues and for federal outlays that is actually part of the electoral mandate?
Scott Parkinson at the Club for Growth. Scott, tell us a little bit about the club.
the club is based out of Washington, D.C., and we're this economic organization that's united in freedom, liberty, and opportunity. You can sign up and become a member of Club for Growth for free at clubforgrowth.org.
Scott Parkinson at the Club for Growth. Scott, we'll check in with you next week. Thank you.
You're welcome.
The future of iconic U.S. steel is now in doubt as President Joe Biden has blocked a takeover of the company by Nippon Steel. For a look at the impact, Eric Boehm of Reason Magazine talks with Ryan Young from the Competitive Enterprise Institute.
Last week, President Joe Biden announced that he was unilaterally blocking the sale of U.S. steel to Nippon Steel. Nippon Steel is the publicly traded company based in Japan, and of course, Japan is one of America's closest foreign allies. But despite that, Biden says that the potential acquisition raised national security concerns. I think what's really going on here is more about politics than anything else. This is a giveaway to Biden's union allies who didn't want the deal to go through. And it is certainly an unprecedented intervention into the economy by a chief executive. So many angles to talk about. We're going to get into all of that today. Hi, folks. I'm Eric Boehm with Reason Magazine. Thanks for joining us on this edition of American Radio Journal. My guest today is Ryan Young. He's a senior economist at the Competitive Enterprise Institute, and he's been following this story going back for months now. Ryan, appreciate you being here on the show now that we've finally got a decision from the Biden administration on this. Thanks for taking some time with us here today.
Thank you, Eric.
So let's get into this. Obviously, many angles here, not a lot of time to explore it all. I think we should start with the economic angle because this decision of Biden to block the sale of U.S. steel just doesn't make much sense from an economics perspective at all.
Yeah, there is no valid economic reason to stop it. If anything, it might actually create a fresh antitrust problem because the leading suitor to buy U.S. steel now is their leading domestic competitor, Cleveland-Cliffs, which has been lobbying very heavily to scuttle Nippon Steel's acquisition. And when Cleveland-Cliffs made an offer, they lowballed Nippon's offer by about a third. So not only would U.S. steel employees get less job security because Cleveland-Cliffs doesn't have the same technology and infrastructure to modernize the plants that Nippon has. It's also bad for shareholders who get less money for the acquisition. It's just a bad deal all around.
Yeah, I'm glad you mentioned that because that's something that I've been thinking about too. Biden has stressed, you know, so much throughout his presidency. The line we keep hearing from him is like, capitalism without competition isn't capitalism, right? We've heard that so many times. They've taken a bunch of different antitrust actions, you know, blocking airline mergers, trying to spur more competition in the meat and poultry industries. All of that, this has been like a big focus for the Biden administration. And then you have Joe Biden on his way out of office, paving the way for what could be effectively a huge monopoly for a lot of different steel products in the U.S. if that Cleveland-Cliffs U.S. steel merger ends up happening because this deal got blocked.
Yeah, that's exactly right. It would lead to a monopoly in several different kinds of steel. And also, it would leave Nippon weaker against China. So here we have a choice, because the real competitor here is Chinese steel, which exceeds U.S. output by a great deal. Nippon strengthening an ailing U.S. steel industry would make both Japan and the U.S. stronger against China. And from a foreign policy perspective, we really need that.
Now, Ryan, I know you're an economist, not a foreign policy guy, but since you mentioned that, I think we do need to talk about this angle of the story, too. The argument that opponents of this deal have made is that, you know, U.S. steel being bought by a foreign company is some sort of national security threat. Now, I look at Nippon Steel and I say, okay, it's a foreign company based in Japan, which is a close U.S. ally. It's also a publicly traded company, which means it's actually owned by shareholders all over the world. It's not like owned by the Japanese government or anything like that. But this is being framed as some sort of national security threat. How do you see that?
There is no truth to that. And if anything, we should be welcoming foreign investment. The U.S. right now already is the world's largest magnet for foreign investment. And the reason for that is because for all our problems, compared to the rest of the world, we have better economic institutions, more secure property rights. So if you're an investor who wants to make an investment that will pay off for years to come and it's in a stable environment that's friendly to entrepreneurs, America's the place to go. And Japan is one of our biggest foreign investors, period. The Nippon Steel proposal was for $14 billion. That's a lot of money, but it's also only about 2% of what Japanese companies invest in the U.S. in a typical year. That's on the order of $700 billion. And the more of that, the better. That's how you create jobs in America. That's how you create more output. That's how you refresh ailing industries. It's a win-win. And President Biden trying to stop that is nothing but a special interest stop.
Yeah, I still can't figure out like how it's okay for Toyota to build factories here and invest in America, but somehow it's not okay for Nippon Steel to buy U.S. steel and invest billions of dollars in American steelmaking. Just doesn't make sense to me. We're talking with Ryan Young. He's a senior economist at the Competitive Enterprise Institute, talking about this honestly mind-boggling decision from the Biden administration, even though it's a decision that I think has been really telegraphed for months now. Biden has said that he didn't like this deal, that he was trying to find ways to block it. Now that's finally happened. Last thing, and I'll let you go after this, just about a minute left here, but quickly, there is that 30-day window. Another important thing is going to happen within those 30 days, and that thing is that Biden will no longer be president. Donald Trump will be inaugurated later this month. Trump has indicated on the campaign trail that he also wanted to block the deal, and J.D. Vance, his incoming vice president, has been even more out there in talking about why he doesn't think this deal should go through. There's reasons for that, of course. Vance is from Ohio. Cleveland Cliffs wants to buy U.S. steel. They're also based in Ohio, all of that. Is there any chance that Trump revisits this, or is there at least the possibility that he could?
It's unlikely. It is possible, but it's unlikely. Although another issue in play is that U.S. Steel and Nippon Steel have filed lawsuits. So maybe Trump will want to stick it to Biden by reversing one of his decisions. That's unlikely, but it is possible. Or maybe the lawsuits will force the hand one way or the other. So it's not over yet, but it sure does feel that way.
Yeah, so it's not over yet, but certainly a big development in this past week in something that's been kind of percolating for the past year or so here. And as I said before, I'll say it again, really just, I think, a mind-boggling decision for the president to tell a company based in a close U.S. ally that for some reason you can't invest billions of dollars in the United States and for American workers. Really just doesn't make a whole lot of sense to me. Ryan, though, thank you for trying to make some sense of it with me. We're unfortunately out of time for today. Thanks for joining us here.
Thank you.
And once again, that's Ryan Young. He's a senior economist at the Competitive Enterprise Institute. You can find his work online at CEI.org. Follow our coverage of this issue and the upcoming inauguration and everything else going on in D.C. and around the country at Reason.com. For Reason Magazine, I'm Eric Boehm. Catch me right back here next week on another edition of American Radio Journal.
Donald Trump is set to take the oath of office as the first president since Grover Cleveland to serve two non-consecutive terms. Colin Hanna of Let Freedom Ring USA looks at what lies ahead on this American Radio Journal commentary.
What can we tell about the next 4 years of Donald Trump from the last 2 months? No incoming president has gone as far and as fast as Trump to name so many of his administration. Trump has announced a daily growing list of executive actions he proposes to take. He has met with heads of state and ambassadors at his Mar-a-Lago club, and he has sent emissaries to meet with allies overseas, thus conducting some level of foreign policy while the current president stands by fecklessly. The Washington Post has said that, quote, less than 2 weeks before taking office, President-elect Donald Trump on Tuesday took some of his most audacious claims and promises of the transition period and amped them up to new levels. Trump said he would not rule out using military force to seize control of the Panama Canal, citing national security interests. Trump also criticized the late President Jimmy Carter just as his remains were being transported to Washington for 3 days of state funeral rites in the Capitol. And he escalated his threats against Hamas, warning anew that all hell will break out in the Middle East if the Israeli hostages still being held in Gaza are not returned before he takes office, hammering home a threat he's been making since last month without detailing what those ramifications could mean. And of course, he suggested that Canada should become our 51st state and that the U.S. should buy Greenland. Many of these will never become serious policy proposals, but some may. The legacy media will become increasingly apoplectic as they try to analyze extravagant comment after comment. I suggest that they're doing so completely misses the point and plays directly into Trump's hand. Trump always wants to control the rhetoric. Unexpected, even shocking remarks and proposals do just that. We have never seen a president whose sheer force of will is so effective. He learned some of what has become his style from his then attorney, Roy Cohn, 50 years ago, notorious for his defense of Joe McCarthy. Cohn's famous advice was, "You might be guilty, it doesn't matter. Don't ever admit guilt." His cousin David Marcus said that Trump was totally taken by Cohn's advice to fight it. Just deny everything and fight. When charged, along with his father, with racial discrimination for denying black applicants apartment housing a half a century ago, Trump followed Cohn's advice and denied discrimination and then countersued the federal government for $100 million. According to Marcus, Donald Trump was on the ropes. There was no doubt they had discriminated. There was no doubt there was wrongdoing. And yet Roy Cohn showed him that you can turn around a situation just by ignoring the facts and going after your attacker. The countersuit failed, and the Trumps ultimately signed a consent decree that required them to make their properties more accessible to minorities, but did not include an admission of guilt. Roy went on the defensive and said, "This is a victory. Trump was vindicated," Marcus says. He knew that the court of public opinion is often more important than a court of law. Trump is still following Cohn's advice to the T. The two most obvious examples are his characterization of the January 6th riots in 2021 and his comments on the recent legal cases against him by E. Jean Carroll, Jack Smith, and Alvin Bragg. With stubborn rhetoric, he has changed public perception of every one of those cases. He continues to insist that everything on January 6th was perfect, patriotic, and beautiful. He used precisely the same language in defending himself in the two impeachment trials. He, quote, "never knew E. Jean Carroll. Alvin Bragg was a political hack pursuing him for what was merely a bookkeeping error. And Judge Mershon's case summary and sentencing were merely the last gasps of a failing case that never should have been brought in the first place." Not even the fabled great communicator Ronald Reagan was so effective in changing public perception as Donald Trump. He has turned diversity, equity, and inclusion into dirty words. Look at how McDonald's, Walmart, John Deere, Lowe's, and Harley-Davidson have disowned DEI just in the last month. Look at the rise of Meloni in Italy, Le Pen in France, and the Conservative Party in Canada. Would any one of those be in the positions they now enjoy if Donald Trump had retreated to his golf courses in humiliation 4 years ago? So while the legacy media continue to sputter rage and disbelief at Trump's almost Artesian outbursts, intelligent observers like the listeners to American Radio Journal should see what many want to dismiss as craziness as, in fact, crazy like a fox. It may be the shortest route to restoring America's economy at home and leadership in the world. This has been Colin Hanna of Let Freedom Ring for American Radio Journal.
American Radio Journal is heard on public affairs-minded radio stations all across the country, including WXRQ-AM in Mount Pleasant, Tennessee, KCLC-FM in St. Charles, Missouri, along with WFAY-AM and FM in Fayetteville, North Carolina. American Radio Journal is produced weekly by the Lincoln Institute of Public Opinion Research, Incorporated. The Lincoln Institute is completely funded through the generosity of individuals, corporations, and philanthropic foundations, which underwrite the costs of this program. Comments and opinions expressed on this program are those of the guests and do not necessarily reflect the views of the Lincoln Institute or of this radio station. Learn more about American Radio Journal and hear expanded versions of some interviews aired on this program. Please visit our website, AmericanRadioJournal.com. I'm Loman Henry. Thank you for listening to American Radio Journal. American Radio Journal. lighting the brush fires of freedom.